session number 24907, reel 9.
Charles Simpson, reel 9. We were talking about your time on HMS Victorious.
Yes.
The aircraft carrier.
Yes.
And can you explain how that time came to an end?
Yes, it was announced that I was to be promoted to Lieutenant E. This came about because there was a great shortage of officers in that rank. And it was decided to select a number of warrant engineers for immediate promotion to lieutenant. A number of fleet promotion boards were held in which those considered to be worthy of immediate promotion appeared before a number of very senior officers who decided to put the candidates in an order of excellence. There was an officer in the warrant officer's mess who was on the admiral staff, and he informed me, as a matter of great secrecy, that of the candidates I had been put into the most worthy selection. So I thought my promotion would follow very quickly, but it didn't. And the Admiralty, in their wisdom, had decided to promote all warrant engineers who had passed the selection board to promote them in the order of their seniority. So, in fact, I had to wait several months before it reached my level of seniority as a warrant engineer. Anyhow, along came the order. I was to be sent to Portsmouth to be prepared for promotion. I spent 6 weeks in HMS Victory with another candidate for promotion, and we were found odd jobs to do. We were required to read engineering manuals, which in the busyness of war was considered the only thing HMS Victory and its staff could provide in the way of a promotion course. But the great day came when it was announced that I was now a lieutenant and I was ordered to change my uniform. So I duly got 2 stripes put in place of 1 thin one, and then I received my appointment to HMS Belfast.
Were there any other changes in your uniform? Were there any other changes to your uniform?
No, just the stripes. And now there is a story about that. Belfast was in the dockyard undergoing a very long refit, amounting almost to a rebuild. And during that time, the naval barracks in Devonport, being so crowded, officers like myself were ordered to find lodgings ashore. So I found, as in Newcastle, somewhere pleasant to live, but this required me to go home to lunch, my temporary home, which I did on a bicycle. And returning from lunch on the bicycle, I was knocked over by a dairy cart, and I was rendered unconscious and woke up to find myself in the hospital. In my bewilderment, when the nurse asked who I was and where I came from, I said, "May I see my uniform jacket?" And when she produced it with two stripes on, I knew that I really was a Lieutenant E. And that, of course, brought my memory back, and I knew that I belonged to HMS Belfast, then in dockyard.
What did you do whilst the Belfast was being refitted?
Well, you will recall that when I went to a new destroyer, I traced every single pipe. Now, as the senior Lieutenant E in the engineering department, I was not required to have such a precise knowledge of the ship, but it behoved me in wartime to be very familiar with the outlay of the department, the nature of all its machinery, and so I occupied the time much the same as with a brand new ship in becoming familiar with the engineering department. But I had to sleep in a civilian house, and Devonport at the time was being subject to intense bombing, a feature of which was they dropped hundreds, if not thousands, of phosphorus bombs, which were intended to light on the roofs of dwellings and set the houses alight. So,
were these the same as incendiary bombs?
Yes, they referred to them as phosphorus bombs, but their purpose was to set things alight. So when the time came to commission Belfast, I was very, very glad to leave Devonport and all its bombs of every nature behind me.
Before we go on to the Belfast, can you tell me a bit about Devonport? Were there any particular incidents of bombing that you were a witness to?
Yes. These phosphorus bombs naturally fell in the street. And although the advice was to sleep in a shelter, having added myself to the household of a normal house, I felt that I would have been an intrusion on the shelter. So I pretended to be brave, and at night time I remained in bed. And so this allowed me, when these horrible phosphorus bombs lit up in the roadway, to go to the window and count how many there were, and to be alert if our particular house received one of these bombs.
When did you finally move on to the Belfast?
Some 2 or 3 weeks before it was due to leave, by which time the cabins were ready. They were still quite primitive because there were no cooking arrangements until a very short time before we were due to leave. Because, of course, we had no cooks on board. So although I slept on board, it was a matter of self-preservation. I felt safer on board the ship, and of course I was available for duty should the ship itself or the dock in which it was lying was damaged.
In addition to yourself, who else was involved in that part of Belfast's history in the time before she was relaunched?
Oh, what one might refer to as a representative of every department, the future gunnery officer joined, head of electrical department also came, so that within 2 or 3 weeks of my joining the Belfast, There were other officers in exactly the same position as myself, or becoming familiar with their departments and writing the necessary orders to control them. I myself drafted a number of orders which were directed towards the future engine officers and all the personnel in my future department.
When was the Belfast relaunched?
It's hard to remember details like that, so I can only guess that it would have been perhaps 5 or 6 weeks before the captain arrived and the ship could be considered, although not actually commissioned, it could be considered a live ship. So I imagine about 5 or 6 before it was due to leave.
And would this be 1942 or 1943?
No, this would have been still in 1942, because we left in November as a fully commissioned ship.
November 42?
Yes. Ready to go off, just like a new ship. We had to undergo trials of every bit of machinery. We had to fire the guns in trial and practice. We naturally had to do a full power trial, just as if we were a newly built ship.
When did the ratings arrive? Did they arrive all at once or in groups?
Yes. A few ratings began to, as it were, dribble on board. It was obvious that to get the ship ready, officers then on board needed a little bit of naval assistance. So they dribbled on board over, I imagine, a couple of weeks. And then came the great day when 95% of the ship's company came on board.
So it was an entirely new crew?
Yes, with one exception. The exception was the Commander E, the head of my department, who had been the Commander E in the Belfast's one and only sister ship called HMS Edinburgh, and she had been sunk and lost completely by a mine. And it appeared that the commander had volunteered to become the chief engineer of the Belfast.
Tell me about the arrival of the captain, and who was the captain?
The captain, who eventually became, in my estimation, the best captain I'd ever had the pleasure to serve with, was Captain Parham, who was a handsome, courteous, and eventually extremely well-loved captain.
How did the ship's company come together? How did it meld into a fighting and working force?
You have to appreciate that under war conditions, departments are insular. An engineer officer, unless he be the one responsible for the maintenance of guns, or unless he be a specialised officer in the sense that his duties are outside the engine department, every department concentrates upon its own duties. And I was not exceptional in knowing nothing about the guns except their position in the ship.
How did the crew come together and make it a working ship? Do you understand the question? I want to know is how you got a new crew, new ship. How did you all gel, as it were?
Partly by sharing such entertainment and sport as were provided when we were in harbour. The one and only time we got together were church services and when we went to what was referred to as clear lower deck. When this was piped, every individual, officers and ratings, not actually on duty, went onto the quarter deck when they were addressed by the captain or by the admiral about forthcoming manoeuvres or to congratulate an individual in the ship's company on receiving a decoration or an award. But there were not many chances in wartime for ship's companies to get together in the same sense that they do in peacetime. There were football matches in Scapa Flow, but they were few and far between because of the appalling weather but there were concerts, marvellous concerts, which were held in a very, very big building on shore, to which ships' companies from all ships in company were invited, and great celebrities in the musical and acting world used to come and provide entertainment for us.
Tell me about your department on the Belfast. How was that organised?
That was left to the senior engineer. When I was first appointed, I was the senior lieutenant E, second to the senior engineer. So it was the officer next above me who actually organised everything to do with the engineering department. I was given command, as it were, of the engine rooms, and I specialised in becoming aware of every nut and bolt in the engine rooms. And my action station, to begin with, was in the after engine room, the senior engineer and Commander E being elsewhere.
Who was the Commander E and who was the senior engineer?
The Commander E was called Salto, and the senior engineer, whose name I've now forgotten, lived in a village in Devonport, whose address always amused me. Because it was something like Cuckoo or some other name which seemed absurd. So I recall him in peacetime, an inhabitant. Anyhow, the senior engineer was promoted to Commander E. And we awaited the arrival of a new senior engineer. But I was going through the ship and I was met in one of the alleyways in the ship by the new Commander Lee, because Commander Salto had been released. I was met by the new Commander Lee, who, with a great smile on his face, said, "Hi, Senior," which informed me in 1 second that he had been to the Admiralty, recommended that I be promoted to acting Lieutenant Commander, and was to become the new Senior Engineer. Now, that completely altered my duties and responsibilities in the engineering department.
In what way?
It is the custom in a very big ship where there is a commandery and a lieutenant commander senior engineer for the commandery to leave the running of the department, the details of day-to-day routine, and the maintenance of the department's machinery to the senior engineer. So it was my responsibility to ensure that everybody in the engine room department knew his precise duties under all circumstances, to be aware that the engineer officers now junior to myself and responsible to me for the running of their own departments. This was a whole-time occupation. I no longer had responsibility for watching artificers in their hour-to-hour maintenance duties, but I made a routine of going to every department for which I'd now become responsible, making notes of any defects that I noticed. I always carried a notebook with me and noted down immediately that such and such a thing was leaking or needed attention. And then I would refer this to the engineer officer actually responsible for that particular part of the department.
And who was below you in the engineering department?
Well, I had four Lieutenant E and four warrant engineers. I leveled in being an acting lieutenant commander. It was a responsible but an extremely uplifting experience to be running the entire department of a ship like a Belfast. I was referred to by everybody as senior, just as the gunnery officer was never referred to by his name. He was always called, in the wardroom and elsewhere, guns. And the torpedo officer was always torps. So in sharing a drink, you would say, "Cheers, guns," or "Cheers, torps." And likewise, people would say, "Cheers, Senior." And this led to a very happy experience. When I was due to leave the Belfast in Shanghai, I contracted a minor disease, which, the warhead. We were in Shanghai and I had contracted a mild disease which made me go to my bunk for a day or two. And to my amazement, the entire number of engineer officers crowded into my cabin. And the commander addressed me, making a nice little speech in anticipation of my leaving, and handed me a silver cigarette box. And the lid of this was inscribed with all the signatures of the engineer officers, and in the centre was the inscription, and it was to our senior.
Now that you'd been promoted, this was the first time that you had lived or used a wardroom.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that was like?
It was much bigger because there were many more commissioned officers, because the ship rapidly became a flagship with Admiral Barnett carried, and he had his own staff of commanders and lieutenant commanders who added considerably to the number of officers in the wardroom. So the chief difference was not only of its size, but of the number of golden rings to be seen around the wardroom. There were, I could almost say, a great many commanders for one ship. They were abundant in the bathhouse. The mess arrangements were different, because instead of being perhaps only one dining table, there were now several. There was no order of precedence in sitting at the table except for the president of the wardroom. We sat where we wished to, and this had the great advantage of bringing me side by side with officers senior to myself who were in charge of other departments. And that was a, one felt at the beginning, was a privilege.
Who was the president of the mess?
The president was the executive commander, who was a gentleman called Tufnell. And he was regarded as a something of a character, which he expressed in his uniform. He had had his tunic cut to a slightly different pattern to the normal double-breasted tunic. He was known to have a flair for entertainment. And as the president of the wardroom, he was able to suggest things that the wardroom as a whole might do whenever we were in harbour, in the way of entertainment of officers from other ships. In particular, of Wren officers, of whom there were a great many up at Scarpa Flow. So he was a great leader in social activity as being next in command of the Belfast.
You would obviously eat in the wardroom. What about, what other activities went on in there?
Well, there were all the usual indoor activities, darts, cards. There was a lot of groups of card players who became habitual card players. One would see the same group of officers only when conditions permitted, playing a hand of whist. But mostly it was talking and, of course, drinking. No officer was allowed to drink to excess, but the wine bill was very generous, because wine and spirits were tax-free. And of course, it was a standing joke that you could have a gin, which cost a bomb on shore, cost only a very small amount in cash added to your wine bill. So you could drink very generously.
Charles Simpson, Reel 10.